The prince's royal wife is installed at the tent of her sister-in-law, Princess Fatima, second wife of Prince Sultan. They say that she would return to the house of her father, but that Abdul Saad won't let her. Of the other concubines, she cares nothing, but the American female is not unknown, and it is becoming a scandal, Abdul replied.
And what of Prince Abdul Saad?
Who can speak of Abdul Saad?
The jeweler said, flipping up his bejeweled eye patch and looking anxiously over his shoulder to be sure they weren't overheard.
Abdul Sa'ad is always surrounded by armed guards, especially the evil-eyed one. He of the Mutayir, Abdul said.
Bandar, breathed the scorpion.
He rides today on Basham, last year's champion. Yes, it is an odd name, isn't it?
Truly, the scorpion replied.
It was odd.
It was as if Abdul Sa'ad couldn't resist announcing his intentions by calling his camel by the word that means sinister, he mused.
There are many who hesitate to contest against him for fear of what he might do, Abdul added.
And Abdul Sa'ad? The scorpion asked.
He is with his brother, the king, at the royal tent. There are many whispers, but no one speaks loud against Abdul Sa'ad. Some say he has become a religious mystic, a Sufi master even.
And Salim?
The king, may Allah guard him, loves and trusts his brother. He will listen to nothing against him.
But that the American female is in the far tent is certain. There can be no mistake on this, the scorpion insisted.
So the women say. Trust the wives to know where the she-wolf is. Besides, who posts an armed guard over an empty tent?
Shrugged the little man.
Anything else? Only that you are watched even now, Abdul remarked, glancing towards the tent flap out of the corner of his eye.
I know. They're all over me like fleas. And they're not bothering to hide either. Something's come unstuck, the scorpion said.
Perhaps it has something to do with the bombing in Qatar last night, Abdul suggested.
He looked anxiously around as a tall, bearded Arab came up to the trough. He was dressed in Western clothes and had the look of a modern riadi.
What bombing? It's on the radio, Abdul said nervously and glanced significantly at the bearded Arab.
He shook himself and turned to leave.
I have no hurry. I'm thinking of betting 10,000 rials on Bashum, ridden by Prince Abdul Saad's man Bandar. What do you think?
Abdul said loudly.
Save your money, I doubt he'll go the distance, the scorpion said, an odd gleam in his eye.
As he turned to leave, the bearded riadi caught at his sleeve.
1,000 pardons, Asayid, the riadi began.
The scorpion's reaction was instantaneous. He splayed the fingers of his hand and rotated his wrist clockwise, then continued in a circle, gripping the riadi's hand between both hands and forcing him to his knees. The scorpion winced as he twisted, his sides still aching from last night's fall in the desert fight.
Who sent you, MacCready?
The scorpion hissed through clenched teeth and applied pressure on the trapped hand. The riadi groaned in pain.
Mr. Harris?
The riadi began in English.
Where is he?
At the tent of the fortune teller,
the riadi began and then blinked in disbelief. The scorpion was already gone. The fortune-teller's tent was blue and decorated with gold and silver stars, a crescent moon, and signs of the zodiac. A sign advertised visions of the future, promises of great wealth, happiness, and cures for arthritis, backache, and a variety of liver and stomach ailments. Circumcisions were also available. Another sign, hand-painted on the tent flap, indicated that the tent was closed for prayers and the duration of the race. Inside, the scorpion found Harris seated at a wooden folding table, playing a hand of solitaire. He smiled as the scorpion entered and gestured as extravagantly as an Arab merchant for him to sit down.
1,000 welcomes, O honored guest,
Harris insolently grinned, leaning back. Who else but Harris would wear a silk ascot at his throat in the middle of Arabia, the scorpion thought. Harris wore a beige tropical jacket over his shoulders, as if he'd just finished playing a polo match. The empty sleeves hung like lifeless limbs as Harris dealt the cards.
Cut the shit, Bob, the scorpion snapped angrily.
What's the matter?
Are you running an op or a Marx Brothers comedy? You've got amateurs tripping all over me.
If you wanted to blow me, it would have been more inconspicuous to use a neon sign. I feel like I'm wearing a bullseye on my chest, the scorpion snapped.
There wasn't time to set it up properly. You know how things can get at this stage, Harris said defensively.
He placed a red 10 on a black jack with a little snap of the card to show his annoyance and pretended to concentrate on the game to show he wasn't worried, which meant, of course, that he was.
If there's a screw-up, I'm surprised you aren't already blaming MacReady, everybody's favorite whipping boy, the scorpion remarked impudently.
MacReady's dead, car bomb in Doha. Surprised you hadn't heard about it on the radio, Harris said complacently.
So that's what Abdul the jeweler had meant, the scorpion thought. He remembered the last time he had seen MacReady, in the alley behind Hamid's.
Why'd you wait so long, MacReady had asked, still trying to get it right as if it was Saigon again, while insects smashed against the streetlight.
Is that all you have to say? The scorpion asked.
What did you expect, taps at Arlington? MacReady is history, Harris shrugged.
What was he up to when he got hit? The scorpion asked, a metallic taste in his mouth that might have been regret or fear.
Who the hell knows? The incompetent son of a bitch didn't leave any messages behind, Harris snapped irritably and turned up three cards. He needed a black six, and the six of clubs came up as the second card. He surreptitiously switched it with the third card and placed it triumphantly on a seven of hearts, glancing at the scorpion to see if he had noticed.
Shouldn't have happened, the scorpion mused, almost to himself.
Of course it shouldn't have happened. We never should have used him in the first place. Of all times to get stuck with a fucked-up has-been, Harris fumed, throwing down the cards in disgust.
No, I mean there was no reason for it. I was the target. The action had shifted away from Qatar, unless...
Unless what? Harris snapped.
He reached into his jacket and took out a tiny battery-powered fan. He turned it on and aimed it point-blank at his own sweat-slick face.
Christ, doesn't it ever cool off here? He muttered irritably.
This is the cool time here, the scorpion remarked. Wait till late afternoon, then it warms up.
Harris snapped off the fan for a second and looked at him as if the scorpion was a waiter who had served him soup with a fly in it.
MacReady was a pathetic shit, and I'm here to see that things go right for a change. I don't give a damn about how hot it gets, and I don't need any smart-ass bullshit, and most of all, I want my questions answered. Now, did MacReady get careless, or was he terminated before he got a message to us? Harris rasped.
Yes, the scorpion replied.
Yes, he got careless, or yes, he was terminated.
Yes, it's true what they say about you, the scorpion shrugged.
What's that? Harris hissed, his eyes as bright and murderous as a reptile's.
MacReady wasn't careless. He was famous for his paranoia, the scorpion said, ignoring Harris's question, knowing it would eat away at Harris later on. The way things were shaping up, that might be the only satisfaction he was going to get out of this assignment.
It felt all wrong, but he didn't know where the problem was. Everything was too straightforward, too convenient. The girl... the assassination attempt, and his enemy Bandar, all here in one place. And the eunuch dead, and the ambush is a failure. So Abdul Saad knew he was here, and that he knew about the coup, yet did nothing, leaving Bandar and the girl in the open for him to get at them. The path to the target was straight ahead, the gate left open and inviting. It was all there, but where was the mistake? What was it MacReady had learned that made it essential to eliminate him, the scorpion wondered.
Forget MacReady. The whole ballgame depends on you being able to stop the hit, Harris snapped.
Where was MacReady hit? How did it happen? The scorpion insisted. There was a key there somewhere. There had to be.
He owed MacReady that much, remembering George and his Vietnamese girl inviting him over for lemon chicken dinner at their little apartment around the corner from the caravel. All of them high on 33 beer and Buddha grass and singing FTA. Fuck the army, celebrating because George had managed to postpone getting DeRose back to the States so he could stay with... what was her name anyway? And in the distance they could hear the soft thumping of Delta Tango rounds fired into the bush, but so far away it could have been the beat of a rock band.
What difference does it make? Listen, Harris said, waving his hand as if to brush away a fly.
Suddenly the scorpion grabbed Harris by his ascot and lifted him off the ground. It makes a difference to me. Where was George when the bomb went off, goddammit? He demanded. In his car, the Corniche, it exploded. A grenade tossed in the window. Motorcycle, no ID, Harris managed to gasp. Which way was the car headed, north or south? I don't know. South, Jesus, Harris shouted. The Scorpion shoved Harris back into the chair. Harris winced and rubbed his neck reproachfully. But the Scorpion ignored him, for a moment staring blankly at the tent wall. Geez, if I'd known it was that important, Harris began. South, back towards the airport. But he had just come from the airport. He'd just returned from Riyadh. And he left no message, right? The Scorpion asked, looking at Harris. Harris nodded slowly. Comprehension dawned in his eyes. The Scorpion was obviously on to something. That meant he wasn't about to take a flight out, or he would have signaled. He had to... He was my case officer. He wouldn't have just gone off. Not with the whole damn Indian Ocean fleet, the RDF, and the Marines waiting somewhere offshore. And it wasn't to send a signal, either. He'd have gone either to the embassy or the safe house for that, even if security had been breached, the Scorpion said. So why did he leave his post? Harris asked. Because he saw something or someone, the Scorpion said, his eyes wide as saucers. Someone on his way to the airport, he breathed. Who could it be? Harris asked, mopping his face with the ascot and rearranging the table, which had been knocked over during their struggle. That's the $64,000 question, isn't it? Harris looked suspiciously at him. You wouldn't be holding out on me, would you? Not telling me for your own reasons? Of course not. Any more than you'd keep something from me, the Scorpion replied. The two men smiled at each other. The Scorpion carefully lowered himself into the chair like someone entering a steaming hot bath. Harris took in his bloodshot eyes and unshaven cheeks. You look like you've been through the mill. Are you going to be able to pull it off? Harris said sympathetically. Do I get a choice? Not at these prices. They shared a quiet chuckle. The President asked me to convey his personal regards and confidence in you. We're all counting on you, Harris said, his voice resonating with manly sincerity. Save the halftime speeches, Bob. The only thing the President's counting on is for me to save his political neck, and that's not number one on my list of things to do today. What about the girl? Harris prompted. Which comes first, stopping the coup or the girl? You know the answer to that as well as I do, Harris snapped peevishly and moved the little fan back and forth across his face like a windshield wiper. He stared at the tiny whirring blades in fascination. A dreamy look came over his face. You know, it's like living a little piece of history, like being in Sarajevo in 1914 or Berlin in 1939. There's an appalling amount of misery in store for humanity if you miss, he said in a philosophical tone, as if he were about to brush a blackboard with tweed-covered elbows. Thanks, Bob. That's just what I needed right now. More pressure, the Scorpion remarked wryly. Harris leaned forward with a worried look. If Harris let that much worry show through, then the Scorpion knew he himself probably had the life expectancy of a rare butterfly at a convention of lepidopterists. Don't miss, Harris said earnestly. How bad is it, can you tell me? The Scorpion asked, glancing around the tent as if to search out any bugs. Harris leaned forward to whisper. We have independent confirmation from both the Israeli Mossad and the Egyptian Mukhabarat of a PLO strike at Sea Island, which would shut off the oil. The Russian fleet is stationed off the Straits of Hormuz, and there have been a number of bow-scraping incidents between them and our Indian Ocean fleet. The RDF and the 82nd Airborne have been committed, and are en route to Masira Island. The Russians have the Caucasus Red Army Group poised at Yerevan, and the Cuban military advisers and Palestinians have suddenly disappeared from the streets of Aden. Just how bad do you want it? I'll tell you, friend, anyone who bought oil futures is going to make a killing, Harris said, then bit his lip as if he had said too much. We're not friends, Bob. We just share the same lifeboat, the Scorpion said quietly. Harris's face flushed. He looked at the scorpion as if that was a remark he was storing away for repayment. Then he smiled bravely, like a heroine in a soap opera. He still needed the scorpion. "How are you going to get away when all the action starts?" Harris asked. "Why, Bob, I didn't know you cared." "I don't. This is business. The embassy can't be involved in any way," Harris said, gathering up the cards. "Good. For a second I thought I was going to have to listen to some of your less credible inventions." "Well," Harris said, looking at his watch as if he had somewhere to go. Then he smiled to show how patient he was. "I'll try to fade in with a mutayer in the desert. I'll contact you," the scorpion said. "Anything else?" Harris asked, rising briskly to his feet. "Yeah. It feels wrong. It's too straightforward. There's a nasty surprise waiting somewhere, but I don't know what," the scorpion admitted. "It's just your devious mind. Abdul Saad's nastier than he is clever. All you have to do is make sure you hit the right target," Harris said, aiming his index finger like a gun at the scorpion. The scorpion stood up and pulled his veil back across his face. "The next time you point something at someone, Bob, I suggest you make it more threatening than a finger," he remarked. The two men faced each other, hatred naked in their eyes. "If you miss the assassin, don't bother to come home, scorpion," Harris said hoarsely. "There's no going home for any of us, Bob. Haven't you learned that yet?" the scorpion replied and headed for the tent flap.
"Forget about MacCready. It can't be that important," Harris called after him.
The scorpion stepped outside and blinked in the bright sunlight. So now it was all up to him, he thought. A single shot with an ancient musket, which was all that security-conscious royal guardsman allowed any contestant to carry. And he had the CM rocket pistol taped to the small of his back for the rescue attempt for Kelly. One-on-one, kill or be killed. Things reduced for a single moment to utter simplicity. Except he couldn't forget about MacCready and how fishy it all smelled, because it was obvious who MacCready must have seen that caused timid George to make a U-turn and start barreling down the corniche towards the airport. The one member of the opposition George could have personally recognized, and all because he, the scorpion, had made a fundamental mistake. Braithwaite was back in the game. The race. The air shimmered in the heat, so that the thousands of camels gathered near the starting line looked as if they were wading in water to their knees. The noise of the rumbling camels, the riders and attendants shouting instructions, and the screaming crowds made ordinary conversation impossible. Yusef, tightening the last cinch on Basbousa, had to shout to be heard by the scorpion standing beside him. "Can you see him?" Yusef shouted. The scorpion shook his head. Together they walked around the camel, checking each tie and rope for tightness. With the scorpion holding the camel's head still, Yusef unslung a water skin and poured water into her nostrils to calm and refresh her. The scorpion had to yank hard on the head rope to control her. The smell of so many camels excited her. An announcement came over the loudspeakers telling the riders to mount. The babble of voices rose in anticipation. The camels grumbled and roared as riders began to mount. One camel nearby rose up and began bucking wildly, tore away from its handlers, and began running desperately out onto the course. Riderless, she raced across the level plain to the raucous cheers of the onlookers. Yusef plucked at the scorpion's sleeve and looked towards the stands. The scorpion followed Yusef's glance, searching among the riders. He understood without words that Yusef had been signaled by his brother Faisal, who had been stationed with binoculars on top of a Toyota truck cab parked behind the crowd. At first the scorpion missed him. Then a tingle of electricity coursed through his body as he recognized Bandar, wearing the red-checked kaffiyeh and uniform of a Royal Army captain. Bandar swung himself into the saddle atop a magnificent brown camel, which the scorpion assumed was the famous Basham. Even after all these years, the scorpion recognized him instantly. In memory, the features and gestures had blurred, but seeing his enemy in the flesh, there was no mistaking him. Like the scorpion, Bandar also wore an ancient musket slung across his back, except that the scorpion was willing to bet that the guts of the musket weren't ancient at all, and that, like the scorpion's musket, it was loaded and ready to fire. Ever since the eunuch had confirmed that Bandar would be the assassin, the scorpion had operated on the hunch that it would happen just that way. A planted bomb under the royal reviewing stand would have been found beforehand by one of the king's own security people. A car bomb was too uncertain. Besides, the royal guardsmen were all bedu, excellent shots and likely to be able to shoot a driver before he came close enough. And even if he did and the bomb exploded, it was too messy. It might miss King Salim and it might get Prince Abdul Saad. The possibility of a number of Saudi soldiers suddenly turning their automatic weapons on the king had to be dismissed, not because it was impossible, but because in the Byzantine atmosphere of the royal court, with intrigue and counterplot as a daily occurrence, there was little likelihood of Abdul Saad training a group of soldiers to kill the king, not one of whom would betray the plot. That left the single assassin with a high-powered rifle approach, the classic method and most difficult to stop. Again, the approach and the getaway were the key problems. The added factor was Bandar himself. Both his skill as a marksman and his vanity in that skill had to be taken into account. And so the assassination method had suggested itself to the scorpion with breathtaking simplicity. As Bandar raced past the royal reviewing stand at the finish line, he would unsling his presumably decorative but actually deadly musket and fire at the king before any of the guards could react. The getaway would be equally simple. Bandar would just sweep past on his camel and continue racing to a getaway vehicle, army helicopter, or whatever Abdul Saad had arranged before anyone could mount a pursuit. The scorpion's own plan to stop the assassination was equally simple. He had to wait till the attempt was already underway, so that it would be too late to put some alternative backup plan into effect. He would have to shoot Bandar at precisely the right instant. Too late, and the king would be dead. Too soon, and he himself would surely be shot down by the king's security forces, mistaking him for an assassin. And Abdul Saad might yet go to a backup method. So he would have to shoot Bandar just before Bandar himself was to fire. The only difficulty he faced was the same one Bandar faced, the trickiness of an accurate shot while riding a camel at full gallop. Yusef slipped under the camel's belly and stood next to the scorpion. "Ya, beloved, beware of the Ru'alai with a thin mustache. Muhammad of Haikul was seen speaking to him," Yusef whispered, indicating a rider with the kind of pencil-thin mustache popular in 1930s high comedies and wearing the black-and-white robe of a Ru'ala noble. The scorpion nodded. "Be sure that our father Zaid and the others leave as soon as the race starts. There may be much shooting and many may die," he said. "Of a certainty, we will all meet at the encampment south of Hafuf, inshallah," Yusef replied. He kept patting the camel's side. His hands were like birds, never still. His eyes were soft, and he avoided looking at the scorpion. "What is it?" the scorpion asked softly. "Last night, driving the Toyuti in the Wadi," Yusef began, hesitating. I know. It is the same for all," the scorpion said and swung himself up into the saddle. He felt constricted by the special mesh fabric wrapped tightly around his chest, and he wondered for the 100th time whether it was worth it. All around, riders were moving towards the starting line. With a tap of the whip and crooning "Grr!" from deep in his throat, he made Basbousa rise in slow, jerky stages like a mechanical creature. "Go with God!" cried Yusef and turned to leave. "And upon thee the blessings of God," the scorpion murmured almost to himself. Basbousa began pulling to the left, and the scorpion shortened the rein, wheeling her in a circle and then stopping her. He pulled her head close and whispered curses like endearments into her ear, breathing the sharp camel smell of her. The air was white with dust as thousands of camels began to rise and gather in clusters near the starting line. There was no order, no course boundaries, and once the race started, no rules. There was only an approximation of a starting line. The finish line was the line of sight from King Salim some 14 miles away. as he reined Busbusa in close to the hind quarters of several other camels, already crowding the starting area, the scorpion turned to glance over at Bandar. The camels around them skipped skittishly, growled, and tried to bite each other. Just then Bandar looked towards him, and their eyes met. It was as if a bolt of lightning crackled between them. They knew each other utterly in that instant, and that only one of them would survive the race. The scorpion could see a curse come to Bandar's lips. He smiled coldly in response, but his stomach felt like a volcano about to erupt. Bandar sneered, then turned and kicked Basham into a lead starting position. Out of the corner of his eye, the scorpion noticed the mustached Rualai edge into position behind him. His back prickled, his spine tensed so tightly for an inevitable bullet that he had to force himself to relax. What other surprises did Abdul Sa'ad have in store for him besides the Rualai, he wondered. The scorpion fastened on a face veil and was not surprised to see Bandar, like most of the riders, follow suit. The air was misty with fine white dust kicked up by thousands of camels. Pressing forward on every side were contestants from almost every tribe on the peninsula. The white and black-clad Ruala from Wadi Sirhan, the dark-garbed Aneza from the great Nafud Desert, from the Najd, the Harb and the Shamar, and the Rashidis, ancient enemies of the House of Saud, and the dark-eyed Hutaim, who looked no man in the eye, the Hawitat, who roamed the Red Sea coast near Aqaba and bowed to no man, the Utaiba out of the mountains, and the Jabal Tawaik, who measure their words as if they were pieces of gold, and from the Hajjaz, the Bali, Juhayna, and the tribes of the holy places, the Al-Jahadila and the Quraysh, tribe of the Prophet himself, who wear the green silk of the Sharif, the soft men of the Gamid, and the Rijal Alma Munjaha, from the green hills of Isir, and the hard tribesmen of the empty quarter, the Katan, Yam, Al-Rashid, the Al-Mura. They have the great soft-footed camels who can cross the endless sands of the Rub al-Khali, and from the Hassa and the Gulf where the oil comes from, the Mutayir, the Awazim, the Bani Khalid, and the Bani Hajir, and those of the lesser tribes. It was a vast panoply of riders out of a distant age, and at the sight of them, the women, veiled and kept to the back, began to trill the eerie cries to frighten off the evil czars of the desert. And a guard unfurled the pennant of Saud, bearing a sword and the words of the Shahada, "There is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet." It was a sight to stir the heart, one few Westerners had ever seen, the scorpion thought, and he felt his own pulse quicken. At the sounding of the starting gun, thousands of camels surged forward over the yellow plains, kicking up sprays of sand as they galloped on. A roar exploded from half a million throats as the riders swept forward in a vast wave, as if a great tribal raid or jihad had been launched. With a cry of hat-tat-tat and a slash of the whip, the scorpion urged the camel forward. Busbusa gathered herself together, then seemed to leap into a furious gallop. Busbusa's stride was very jerky, and the scorpion had to hang on desperately, leaning far forward over her outstretched neck to guide her into a smoother pace. Excited riders around him jostled against her flanks, then pulled away as space began to open up between the camels. Busbusa tried to veer left, but the scorpion guided her into a gap between two fierce Hawitat riders, furiously whipping their light-colored talools on. Now he was comfortably situated in the middle of the pack. As Busbusa settled into a smooth motion, which, with her long stride, enabled her to start gaining on the other camels, the scorpion was able to look around for Bandar. A chill passed through him. He couldn't locate Bandar. He should have been ahead and off to the left and fairly easy to spot in his army uniform, but he was nowhere in sight. The scorpion twisted left and right, but he saw only other riders and in the far distance, screaming crowds, partially obscured by the fine white dust which filled the air as the camels pounded across the sands. To the right and behind him, he spotted the mustached Rualai trying to cut obliquely behind another rider and angle towards him. But where was Bandar? The scorpion pulled back on the reins, and Busbusa obediently began to slow down. With whoops of delight, the two Hawitat riders surged past him. Others followed. The scorpion half stood, balancing only on the balls of his feet, and Busbusa bobbed beneath him, desperately scanning the course. Bandar had somehow disappeared. Then he glanced back over his shoulder and spotted the veiled Bandar far behind him. Incredibly, it appeared that he was just mounting up. He must have dismounted for some reason just before the starting gun, but why? What was he up to, the scorpion wondered. But there was no time to think about it. Bashum, Bandar's magnificent brown camel, was already galloping in that high-prancing, almost mincing gait characteristic of the best racing camels and gaining rapidly on the early stragglers. Bandar was leaning forward, riding well, his red-checked headcloth fluttering behind him in the breeze. He was moving off towards the left sideline near the crowds. If he stayed close to the sidelines, it would give him easy shooting distance to the king, perhaps 20 yards at most. Even a mediocre Bedou marksman could hardly miss at that range, and Bandar was a world-class shot, the scorpion mused grimly. All around him, as far as the eye could see, thousands of camels pounded ahead, the drumming of their feet on the hard-packed sand making the earth tremble with an oddly muffled sound like rain. He gave Basbousa a little more slack, allowing her to stretch her neck out and add an inch or two to her stride, letting her step up the pace but still saving her, because it was a long race and he didn't know how much effort he'd need from her. He felt her rocking under him, planting her feet just so, as if she knew exactly what she had to do. She started to overtake a small grouping of soft-soled Nafud camels, ridden by Anaiza tribesmen in their blue-black bishts. She was galloping easily, with plenty of reserve left, when he noticed Bandar sweeping ahead along the sideline. Bandar's head was down, and he was flailing Basham with his whip. The big brown camel was beautiful as he struck out with those long legs that seemed to go on forever, moving as if the other camels were standing still and holding so level and smooth that it gave the scorpion a hollow feeling just watching him. Basham looked as if he were prancing on parade, with enough left to do it all day, and yet he was passing camels one after another. The crowd was delirious, calling, "Basham, Basham," and the scorpion suddenly felt his insides turn to water. He was in a race, and if he didn't do something in a hurry, Bandar would be too far ahead to head off. He started to angle Basbousa towards the sideline for a run at Basham, who was already a good 20 meters ahead. As he raised his whip to urge Basbousa on, he felt it jerked out of his hand. As he whirled towards the right, some instinct caused him to duck, saving his life as a bullet whizzed by his ear. The mustached Ruwalai had come up behind him to within a yard and had used his own whip to yank the scorpions away. He was aiming a pistol, the barrel covered by the bulbous snout of a silencer, at the scorpion's head. The scorpion had barely an instant left. Only luck had saved him. There was only one thing he could do. Any distance between them would be fatal, he thought. He swerved Basbousa into the path of the Ruwalai's she-camel. As the two camels collided, the scorpion heard the popping of another shot. He couldn't look. The impact had jarred his balance, and he clung to the pommel for all he was worth. He heard a loud grunt somewhere ahead of him, and was vaguely aware that a rider had gone down. An inhuman screaming gave him the sickening realization that the downed rider was being trampled by the onrushing camels, even as he himself desperately struggled not to fall off Basbousa. The collision had broken her stride, and she was bucking badly to stay up. The other she-camel had stumbled, and in so doing had saved his life by spoiling the Ruwalai's aim. The Ruwalai had been forced to hang on with his whip in order to stay up. That gave the scorpion what he knew would be the only chance he would ever have. As the Ruwalai drew abreast on his bucking she-camel and started to level the pistol, the scorpion pulled his kanjar from his sheath and flung the blade across his body as though throwing a frisbee. The blade flashed for an instant in the sun like a strobe before burying itself in the Ruwalai's neck. The gun wavered as the Ruwalai's eyes turned red and empty, and then it fell from the trembling hand. A blood-red arc of blood spurted from the Ruwalai's neck even before he went down. As he slumped off the camel, his head began to flop to one side. The neck muscles on that side had been severed. The scorpion's sleeve was splattered with the Ruwalai's blood. So close had they come. With a savage yank on the rein, he pulled Basbousa into a steadier gait and away from the now riderless she-camel, who was running aimlessly across the line of oncoming riders, dragging the dead Ruwalai behind her, his foot caught in a stirrup. The scorpion raised himself as high as he could and urgently scanned ahead for Bandar. He groaned inwardly when he spotted Bandar flying along the sideline a good 100 meters ahead and gaining. They had already passed the television platform at the halfway mark, and the gap between him and Bandar was widening. Worse, he had lost his whip. He had to do something, or the king was certain to die, and Kelly, too, a small voice whispered inside him. Holding the reins in his teeth to keep Vasbusa heading straight, the scorpion tore at the fringed leather cartridge belt around his waist. Freeing it, he grabbed the reins with his left hand and veered Vasbusa towards the sideline, cutting across the path of an onrushing Harb rider, his eyes wide with fear. The scorpion slashed at Vasbusa's flanks as hard as he could with the cartridge belt, hitting her again and again as he shouted, "Alan, now, my beauty, my she-bitch," into the camel's ear and urged her into a flat-out gallop. It was like dropping off a cliff, so sudden was Vasbusa's acceleration. She crossed just in front of the Harb's camel, her tail in its face, as she shot obliquely towards the sideline, then, at a touch from the scorpion, galloped after Bandar, who was flying well ahead. She was moving very fast, overtaking one camel after another. The roar of the nearby crowd, almost near enough to touch, was in his ear as they thundered after Bandar, who had overtaken the leaders and had broken into the clear with no one in front of him. He was still a good 80 meters ahead and moving strongly, holding the pace with only a mile to go. Vasbusa was bleeding where the scorpion had whipped her, and her mouth foamed green with slime. Her breath was beginning to labor, but the scorpion sensed that she still had those reserves he had saved for her. "Alan, now!" he called again to her, and she thundered ahead, almost wild, her ears flat against her head. He was only 60 meters behind now, but his way was blocked by 2 nagged camels, running neck and neck. They were too close together to slip between, and he would lose too much ground if he tried to go around them. Worse, the finish line was fast approaching, perhaps only a quarter mile away. He saw Bandar reach behind him and unsling his musket. The onlookers would no doubt assume that it was to fire a victory volley, but the scorpion knew that there were only seconds left. But he couldn't shoot through the 2 riders blocking him, and it was still too far a shot. There was only 1 chance left. It was a long shot at best, and he would have barely a millisecond to aim from such a position. It would require going flat out with Bandar, plus incredible riding skill and balance. In the instant in time when he realized this, he expressed none of it with words, only saying, "inside and up," to himself. That, and the knowledge that, ready or not, this was his moment, and it would never come again. He slashed once, viciously, at Vasbusa with a cartridge belt, then flung it away as he steered her next to the sideline rope, almost running over a guard as he jostled against the near camel, barely slipping through on the inside. The noise of the crowd was like a windstorm as he dropped the reins and let Vasbusa run wild and free. The camel extended her neck almost parallel to the ground and thundered forward, inching ahead of the 2 riders beside him. He could see Bandar clearly now. He was only 40 meters ahead and approaching the finish line. He was just starting to swing the musket into the firing position against his shoulder. There were shrieks and gasps from the crowd, but it was all happening too quickly for anyone to react. Others screamed wildly as they saw the scorpion suddenly stand almost fully erect atop the charging Vasbusa and snap his own musket into firing position. He had the sensation of falling, even as he stood, but he knew it didn't matter because there was only that millisecond and he couldn't hear the crowd, or feel the camel pounding beneath him, or see anything beyond the sight at the end of his gun barrel moving towards Bandar. And then it was like looking down a dark tunnel at a distant shape silhouetted against the light, as the sight on the front of the ancient barrel came to rest lightly as a butterfly on Bandar's back, and the scorpion discovered that he had squeezed the trigger before he had realized it. For what seemed like minutes, but must have been a second or two at most, Bandar aimed directly at the king as he swept by the finish line. Then he seemed to throw his rifle forward, as if he had been violently shoved from behind. As the scorpion threw his own musket away and slid back down to a squatting position, Bandar started to tilt sideways. Reaching forward alongside Vasbusa's neck to grab back the rein, the scorpion watched Bandar topple to the ground, his arms flung wide as if to catch at something. As Bandar hit the ground, Vasbusa's giant foot came slamming down on his face, crushing it. But Bandar was beyond screaming. The scorpion spotted a gap in the rope barrier just past the reviewing stand and swerved Vasbusa into it, barely missing royal guards who dived out of the way at the last second. The scorpion bent low as Vasbusa raced through the royal compound, a few wild shots ringing out behind him. But it had all happened too quickly for them to react, he told himself, as he headed for Abdul Saad's tent and Kelly. He struggled with the holster at the small of his back as he slalomed between the tents. Women screamed and figures raced back and forth without registering on him. Ahead he could only see the black and white tent. In front of it the eunuch stood brandishing the sword and shaking hands. The scorpion managed to free the pistol just as Basbousa came pounding up to the tent. As he started to aim, the eunuch shrieked and dropped the sword. He fled behind a nearby tent, screaming. The scorpion knew he had only seconds before half of Arabia was on him. He leaped from the camel and yanked at the tent flap, but it was fastened shut. As he picked up the eunuch's sword, he heard screaming and gunshots and the sound of a helicopter from the direction of the royal reviewing stand. Something had gone wrong, very wrong. But he had no time to find out what had happened. He had to get Kelly now. It was the only chance either of them would ever have. With a single sword slash, he cut an opening in the side and stepped into the cool, dark interior of the tent. The tent was completely empty, except for a single female figure veiled from head to foot and seated on a chair in the center. She was so perfectly still that she had to be either bound and gagged or asleep, he thought. He refused to even think of the possibility that she might be dead. As he ran to free her, he heard odd sounds from outside, muffled by the tent fabric. Something very strange had happened, but all he could think about now was Kelly. He placed his hand on her shoulder and ripped the veil from her face. He staggered back in shock, unable to believe his eyes, because it wasn't Kelly, but a department store mannequin tied to the chair. Its face was white as marble, the painted eyes at once doll-like and sinister. He barely had time to react or even realize what a fool he had been when the sound of a gun being cocked caused him to whirl around. Standing only a few feet away was Bandar, his good eye glittering like dark ice. He was very much alive, and he had an AK-47 pointed straight at the scorpion's chest, as did a dozen more of Abdul Saad's soldiers stationed all around the tent. The Ruins of Daria.
All that bravery were wasted. How silly, dear boy,
Braithwaite said, fondly patting the scorpion's knee. They were in a silver-gray Mercedes limousine racing down an untrafficked single-lane road. The scorpion's hands and feet were tightly tied with nylon flex. He sat in the middle of the back seat, wedged between Braithwaite on one side and an unsmiling Shiite on the other. The Shiite kept a Valter automatic jammed into the scorpion's ribs. Facing the scorpion on one of the jump seats was Bandar, lovingly caressing an AK-47 pointed at the scorpion's chest. The scorpion would have recognized Bandar anywhere, even after all these years. Bandar's bad eye was white as a statue's. It had no iris, no center. His mustache was ragged and he needed a shave. He would always need a shave. His lower lip had a hungry droop to it, as if he had swallowed something dark and squashy. He looked at the scorpion with a kind of triumphant hatred. If a spider had a face, it would have an expression like Bandar's as it prepared to devour a fly. The others in the limo weren't that pretty either. One of Abdul Saad's soldiers, a man with an ugly hair lip, sat next to the driver, who glanced with frank curiosity at the scorpion in the rearview mirror. After all, it is always interesting to observe the face of a man about to die. Braithwaite, on the other hand, was positively beaming. He seemed a lot younger. Then the scorpion realized that Braithwaite had dyed his hair jet black and made him look like one of those aging Lotharios at singles bars trying to charm sweet young things with hints of convertibles and condominiums and trips to places with palm trees on the brochures. The scorpion glanced out of the window. The sun was high and there were no shadows cast by the distant Jabal Tuaik. The yellow desert was empty and still. A telephone line ran alongside the road. The line drooped in long valleys between the widely separated metal telephone poles. He watched the wire rising and falling like the sea as they rode along. "So it was a snatch, not a hit," the scorpion said, the metallic taste of failure in his throat, somehow more bitter than the knowledge that he was about to die. They just wanted to do it where it would be more convenient.
Quite. The assassination was a red herring all along, Braithwaite cheerfully agreed.
Oh, Ralph, what you did for love, the scorpion sighed. Braithwaite smiled. Is this a mare? The scorpion asked, glancing sideways at the sullen-faced Shiite with a Valter.
All in good time, you rogue,
Braithwaite smiled, batting his eyelashes like an ingenue.
"Just out of curiosity, who did I kill?" the Scorpion asked.
"No one important. Just one of Abdul Saad's men who had no idea what he was volunteering for," Braithwaite replied, airily gesturing as if to brush aside a cobweb.
"We switched at the start of the race. That's why we were off so late. The prince said you would not suspect, and he was right. Where is your sting now, O Scorpion?"
Bandar mocked in a harsh, guttural voice. His smile revealed brown and broken teeth, like stained and tilted gravestones in an old church cemetery.
"You're still the same charmer you always were, Bandar," the Scorpion observed mildly.
Bandar's face tightened like a fist. He slapped the Scorpion viciously across the lips. The Scorpion licked at a trickle of blood out of the corner of his mouth.
"Knowing it was Bandar, I was bound to believe he would be used for an assassination," he continued conversationally.
"The assassination attempt was the perfect cover for Abdul Saad to bring in a helicopter to spirit His Majesty away, presumably to safety. He actually managed to incorporate you into his plan. You were quite useful, dear boy,"
Braithwaite smiled. "Ingenious," the Scorpion admitted. "It was. Everyone had underestimated Abdul Saad."
"Oh, the Russians will have their hands full trying to run Abdul Saad,"
Braithwaite said cheerfully, as if reading the Scorpion's mind. Hearing him say that made the Scorpion's heart sink with certainty. Braithwaite would never have mentioned the Russians unless they planned to kill him.
"So the Russians are finally moving south after all these centuries," he mused aloud.
"Not quite yet, dear boy. But the revolt is on. The Shiites are rioting in Katif. The Yemenis are moving into the Tiamat, pushing towards Mecca. And the PLO are blowing up the oil facilities at Ras Tanura and Sea Island."
"No more filthy Yankee dogs," Bandar growled.
"Only Russian dogs now," the Scorpion shrugged as best he could, and was rewarded with a flicker of something in Bandar's one good eye.
"Oh, surely you knew the Russians were in on it, dear boy. We always assume that," Braithwaite said.
He seemed years younger. His eyes were positively sparkling. And then the Scorpion realized what it was. Too late, he thought bitterly. He had understood everything too late.
"So you're back in the game at last, Ralph," the Scorpion said.
"You all wrote me off, a has-been. I'm only taking my due, dear boy," Braithwaite said.
It reminded the Scorpion of an old saying of Sheikh Zayed's.
"Take what you want," said Allah. "Take it and pay for it."
"You lied to me, Ralph," the Scorpion said softly.
"You are naive, dear boy. I'm a spy. Lying is my business," Braithwaite snorted.
They drove to the ancient ruins of Dariyah, lying desolate and abandoned in the desert. They left the limo and marched him through the rubble of the empty city, the roofless ruins of the ancient mud-brick fortress rising in jagged spires to the perfect blue sky. The town had been abandoned long ago. No one knew why. But there were whispers that it was inhabited by Afrit and Zars and other evil spirits. They stood the Scorpion next to the lip of an old dry well, as two of Bandar's men struggled to move the massive stone covering the mouth of the well. The Scorpion's mind was racing. He remembered Sheikh Zayed teaching him how a scorpion will sting itself rather than be taken alive. He thought of how most of the wells in this part of the Najd were about 20 feet deep, and sand often seeped in when the wells went dry. Most of all, he was counting on Bandar's vanity and skill.
"Where is the king?" the Scorpion asked.
Quite nearby," Braithwaite said, unable to resist a glance at the old fortress. "Prince Abdul Saad is persuading Salim to abdicate in favor of Abdul Saad."
A faint cry, thin and distant like a bird trill, came from the direction of an ancient tower. Bandar smiled. "Shouldn't take long now," Braithwaite remarked, squinting at the scorpion in the bright sunlight. Bandar stood near the lip of the well and called down. "Kelly," the scorpion thought, his heart leaping.
"Do you want up? Be for me? No more escape or stay under dark? Think more?"
Bandar called down in clumsy English.
"Leave me alone," a defiant voice echoed from the depths of the well.
"Good girl," the scorpion thought.
"Not alone. I send friend. Keep company on you,"
Bandar growled. The scorpion's heart pounded. He stood alone on the lip of the well, his hands still bound behind him. He looked around at the silhouettes of the ruins against the blue sky, blue and unblemished from horizon to horizon. At that moment, he never had wanted to live so badly. Bandar had backed away about 20 feet and cocked the AK-47. The sound of the bolt slamming home had a feel of terrible finality.
"Because you are a mutairi, I give you a choice to be a man. Do you want it in the head or the heart?"
Bandar called, sighting at the scorpion. The others stood there, watching.
"Heart. And I bet you can't do it with a single shot, you sliming offspring of a Hatimi camel," the scorpion shouted, his mouth dry as the desert.
Bandar's face was terrible to see in that last moment. The scorpion's last conscious memory was the sound of a single shot and the impact of a terrible blow in his chest, sending him flying backwards into the well.
The Well of Death. The scorpion was awakened by the most hideous sound he had ever heard, the scraping of his coffin lid as it closed over him. He opened his eyes and saw only blackness. He tried to fight the panic bubbling up inside him, but the thought of being trapped forever in the dark was overwhelming. A groan escaped his lips.
"Oh, dear God, it's alive!"
a frightened female voice cried out in the darkness, and he suddenly remembered everything. The scraping sound was the heavy stone that sealed the old well being rolled back into place. He was trapped like a fly in a bottle.
"Please, if you're alive, say something,"
the frightened female voice said. She was very near. He could feel her breath on his cheek.
"Hello, Kelly," the scorpion said.
"Oh, God,"
she groaned and began to cry. He could feel her tears dripping onto his lips like raindrops. He licked his lips. They tasted salty. There was a hysterical note somewhere in her crying, like a piano with a bad key, and he knew that she was very close to the edge. He stretched his neck up and grazed her cheek with his lips. It felt as soft as a bird's down.
"So soft," she murmured, and then it hit her.
He heard the rustle of her clothes as she sat up sharply in the pitch darkness, the hysterical note giving a stridency to her voice.
"But you're dead. They shot you," she said.
"The bullet hit a transmitter over my heart, wrapped in a special bulletproof plastic mesh fabric. Bandar is a world-class shot, and I was counting on his accuracy, only I thought he would try a shot at the race, not later on."
"The race? They mean to kidnap the king," she exclaimed.
"It's already happened," he said.
"But you must be the American agent they were talking about, the scorpion," she said.
"I'm here to get you out," he said.
"Fine job you're doing of it,"
she snorted, and it seemed so funny that they both couldn't help laughing, the sounds of laughter echoing in the well.
"I've had better days," the scorpion admitted, and that set them both off again. They laughed till their sides hurt, and as the echoes died down, somehow the darkness seemed a bit friendlier.
"What are we to do?"
she asked at last, a pensive note in her voice. It was an interesting voice, smooth as cream, with a catch in it, and he felt he was truly hearing it for the first time without the fear. But it had such sadness in it, and he sensed how terrible it had been for her.
"I'm taking you home," he said softly.
"Oh, sure. I've tried to escape, but they keep catching me," she began bitterly.
"This time we finally have a couple of advantages."
"Like?"
"For one thing, they think I'm dead."
"Might as well be, trapped in here,"
she muttered glumly.
"Don't ever say that, ever. Life is everything, death is nothing," he snapped, his voice like a whiplash.
He had to jolt her out of it, and it was time to see what she was made of, he thought.
I'm sorry, I... Well, you're stubborn, I'll give you that, she admitted.
Stubbornness is a survival characteristic, one of the two key characteristics, he said, remembering the gospel as Koenig used to expound it in that Quonset hut hidden in the green Virginian countryside.
What's the other?
Intelligence.
When do we get to the intelligent part? She asked, forcing him to smile again.
We're already there. Help is probably already on the way. I'll be sure once I check my transmitter.
Well, what are you waiting for? She asked.
You, to untie my hands, he said.
I'll do better than that. I'll cut you loose, she said brightly.
You have a knife, he exclaimed.
Sort of. It's an old stone thing I found in the sands down here. It's sharp enough, she said, showing him a flint chisel, its edges chipped and serrated, perhaps left behind by some ancient workman eons ago.
It's perfect, he said.
Before they threw you in here, I was thinking of using it on myself, she added softly, then caught herself. I don't know why I told you that, she said.
I think it's the darkness. It's like a confessional. In here, appearances can't get in the way of our true selves. There's no image to pierce or hide behind, he said.
I'm not that brave. I've always used my looks. Maybe there's no substance to me at all. Maybe my appearance is me.
No one's that brave. And if all you were was a pretty female, they'd have turned you into a house pet by now, he replied.
And you, mister, whatever your name is.
Nick. Call me Nick. You're one of the only people in the world to know it, he said, his voice thickening as if he were catching cold.
And you, Nick, what's your secret?
Untie me first, he said.
I'm afraid of you,
she said, her voice small and little girlish. Look where we both are, Kelly. What do you have to lose?
Well, that's the damn truth, she admitted, and began groping in the dark, feeling for his hands, still bound behind him.
He felt a tugging as she sawed at the knots, and then his hands were free. He unwrapped the cords from his wrists and rubbed them hard. His hands tingled painfully, and he was sore in a dozen places from the shot and the fall. He tried to stretch and winced at the pain. His back felt as if it had been used for karate practice.
What is it? She asked.
Just thinking about how attractive almost any other line of work looks right now, he said, listening to his vertebrae cracking like walnuts as he stretched. Thank Allah for the sand. It had cushioned his fall. Now it felt smooth and cool as he felt his way around the well in the darkness. The mound of sand sloped down on all sides from the center, and the well had a diameter of about 6 feet. The walls were rough sandstone. If only he had a light, he thought. I wish we had some light, he said.
We do. I have a lamp. Abdul Saad's orders. I put it out when I heard them opening the stone, she said,
flicking on a gold and diamond Dunhill lighter and lighting the spout of an old oil lamp. Her face was gold and shattered in the flame light, like a face on a Renaissance church panel. She was even more beautiful than her pictures had suggested, and it was all he could do to keep himself from grabbing her. Having come so close to dying, the life force surged inside him, and at that moment he had never wanted a woman so badly. He felt himself coming so sharply erect, it was almost painful. But she had been so badly used by others, he told himself bitterly. She was fragile and wounded, and the last thing she needed was another man just grabbing at her. She held the lamp up to see him better.
You have an interesting face. Not a pretty face, but one can see something in it. I can see why there have been whispers about you, she murmured almost to herself.
In the desert, a whisper is only the sound of the wind on the sands, he said.
No, it's more than that. You're a kind of legend. Some of the soldiers said you were a demon. Others said you were an assassin. What will they say now if you return from the dead? That the scorpion is a kind of god.
Ignorant people always try to make good men into mediocre gods, he said impatiently.
He could smell the closeness of her. There was a clean sweetness about it, like the desert at dawn.
What else have you got? He asked, clenching his fists to keep from taking her in his arms.
I don't know. There's an old stick in here. It looks like it might have been part of an ancient spear, she said.
What else?
That's all there is, except for me,
she said. She was very close. They were almost touching. The tips of her breasts grazed the bulletproof fabric wrapped around his chest. "The transmitter!" he shouted suddenly, bringing them both out of a trance. They hurriedly unwound the dense plastic mesh from around his chest. He brought the lamp close to check the transmitter. Even protected by the bulletproof plastic, the bullet had still managed to smash the metallic casing. The transmitter had saved his life, but it was useless now.
"No help," she said, crestfallen.
"Not necessarily," he said.
"I don't follow."
"If you were tracking somebody and all of a sudden the transmission stopped, where would you look for them?" he said, grinning.
"The last place the signal came from," she said brightly.
"It's a bit of a stretch, but I think even those room-temperature IQ geniuses in the CIA can figure out that much."
"But can they find you from that?" she asked dubiously.
"The signal from this is designed to be picked up by a receiver in an SR-71 flying too high to be seen or heard and bounced back to a raven on the ground. I think our side knows exactly where we are," he said confidently. It sounded good, he thought. With a little luck, it might even be true. But he'd already had a lot of luck. Too much, he thought. In battle, two mistakes are not permitted, Sheikh Zayed used to say. But they'd need every bit of luck, because unless an overflight had picked up his last signal as the bullet smashed the transmitter, they'd had it. Because even if he could somehow get them out of the well, he couldn't take on all of Abdul Saad's men single-handed. They'd need an army of scorpions to do that, he thought.
"How does it feel to come back from death?"
she asked, her voice sounding odd in the shadowy light as she fingered the smashed transmitter. For a moment, the odd note confused him, and then he recognized it. She was beginning to hope again. The life force was surging inside of her, too. His pulse began to throb in his temple like a drumbeat. "It feels like I've been blind all my life, and suddenly opened my eyes on a magnificent sunrise," he whispered. She came up to him and rested her silky head on his shoulder.
"It's like electricity," she whispered,
her fingers dancing lightly down his chest. Every place she touched tingled with a feeling that had no name. He had almost forgotten how special it could be. He felt himself being drawn to her like an iron filing to a magnet, and then he couldn't stop himself. His arms wrapped around her. He could feel her body trembling against him, and their lips found each other. They were so soft and salty because she was silently crying, and then they were grabbing desperately at each other like survivors from a shipwreck. Their mouths sought each other out, tongues exploring, and they shared the sensation of floating in the shadows of space.
"Oh God, I want you. Make me feel. For the first time in so long, make me alive," she cried, her hands groping at his clothes, tugging him free as they sank down to the soft, cool sand.
He felt the quickening gathering inside him as he explored her naked body in the flickering light. He pressed his mouth against the soft mounds of her breasts, grazing her erect nipples with his lips, then down to the dimple of her navel and on down to the soft skin of her belly, while his hands caressed her silky thighs and the moistness between them.
"Tell me your secret now," she whispered,
pulling him to her, guiding him to her center and wrapping her long legs around his hips.
"You're my secret," he gasped, feeling the old, familiar, yet almost forgotten excitement as he entered her. "Don't hurt me," she cried.
And then her words were no longer words as they began the ancient rhythm. Their shadows moved and intertwined in the light of the flame like fingers from the dawn of time. He must have slept for a few minutes, because when he awoke, cradled in her arms, he thought he was with Tuyet and the child that last night on the sampan. He remembered how the sentries had refused to let her into the embassy compound to catch the last choppers evacuating the city at the last minute. He had left the embassy and had raced through the city streets, the pounding of the heavy guns drawing nearer as the North Vietnamese prepared to enter the city. The sound of Bing Crosby singing White Christmas came from 100 radios along the way. It was supposed to be the evacuation signal, and it became a kind of theme as he ran, and he knew he would never be able to hear it again without remembering Saigon and that endless day. It was McVie's last foul-up, because they'd had to shut down Tan Son Nhut Airport, and there weren't enough choppers to ferry out anyone who wasn't American. They made their escape by sampan that night, with the city full of North Vietnamese regulars and the water red with the reflections of flames along the shores of the Saigon River. Then the VC gunboat opened fire, and Tuyet grunted with surprise as a white-hot round passed through her and the baby. "Does it hurt?" he had asked.
"Titi,"
which was pidgin for "a little," she had replied. And then they were in the water because the gunboat had rammed them, and he was flung out into the burning river.
"You're so